Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Wing, the host of Sound Effect. Last May, hundreds of people came to Seattle's Town Hall for a live show, an evening of storytelling and music. If you weren't there, well, you're in luck because we recorded all of the conversations, the readings, and the songs that were shared that evening. 88.5's Gabriel Spitzer starts things off by making a mental connection between people, stories, and a candy. Enjoy.
So, our show, Sound Effect, it's kind of about a way of looking at the Pacific Northwest and about the people that we live among. And it kind of gets across this whole idea of like people that you run into on the street or the person you sit next to on the bus or your waiter or a homeless person or whoever. Any of those people, if you grab them and you turn them upside down, you shake them a little bit, a story is probably going to fall out. And chances are it's going to be a really interesting and important and powerful and compelling story too. And I just see the world this way now. I look around and you're all just a bunch of big old stories walking around on two legs. And this is my sort of analogy. This is going to make more sense if you're of a certain generation. But in the 1970s and 80s, there was a commercial for this particular candy company. And the whole idea was that the kid loved Tootsie Rolls so much that everything he looked at looked like a Tootsie Roll. Whatever it is I think I see becomes a Tootsie Roll to me. Well, that's how I see the world, except instead of Tootsie Rolls, everybody looks like a story. And that's kind of what we get across in our show. And I think we have a fellow traveler in our first guest. Tim Durkin, when he turns his camera on people, especially when it's someone who maybe we have a tendency to look past or to not see, his camera captures them in the fullness of their humanity and the fullness of their story. And it really comes across in his photographs. If you don't know Tim, Tim is a pretty prominent photographer here around Seattle. He's a longtime denizen of Capitol Hill. And he's also the scion of a really important political family here in Washington. His father was a prominent state legislator. His sister Jenny was a U.S. attorney here in Seattle for quite some time. And Tim has worked in and on the periphery of politics through several mayoral administrations. But if you do know Tim, chances are you probably know him for something a little bit like this. Could we look at Tim's beautiful Space Needle picture, Judy? Boop, there we go. That's just one part of Tim's amazing photography, his incredible oeuvre, and there's a lot more. We're going to learn a little bit more about it tonight. Would you please welcome Tim Durkin? Hey man, get comfortable. Cozy up to that microphone.
Thank you, brother.
So Tim, how do you get a picture like that? Is that just, do you lean out your front window and just snap it with your phone?
It's that easy. It really is. You know, that picture was taken with this camera. That camera cost about $10,000 and a relationship. And other than that, it was a pretty simple affair. Actually, on this morning, you know, it was one of those mornings in Seattle. I'd had a horrible temperature. I had pneumonia and I'd been in bed all day. So typically when I get out of bed at the rough hour of around 2 p.m., I throw open the curtains and I say, what's going to happen? What kind of clouds? What kind of excitement is there in the air? And on this day, I was like, please, please, don't let there be anything worth it. And I open my curtains and there it is. And I've got my big boy pants on and I went and got the shot. And just 24 hours later, I got a call from NBC's Meet the Press. It was David Gregory's personal assistant, and asked him if I could if they could use the picture, and on the show. And I didn't believe him at first, so I'm like, "Why don't you just go ahead and put David on speakerphone real quick?" And they did. And he was like, "Tim, we love the picture, man. Can we roll with this? It's going to be you. The president's got a picture he took, and so, Banksy is going to be on there." And I'm like, who gets to go first? It's like, we got to put the president on first, Tim, but then you'll go in front of Banksy. So I was like, okay, I can live with that. Thank you, Mr. Gregory. So that was the story behind my foggy needle shot. It was one of my first pictures that got a national audience, and yeah, it's our hometown, you know.
Yeah, the photos are just elegant and say so much about the place that we live. And there's a whole other side, though, to the place we live in and to your interests as a photographer. And this is probably a good jumping off place for it. This is a half your career, if not more, is taking photographs like this. Can you explain what this is?
Yeah, so, you know, anybody who lives in Seattle or who has lived in any major city here in America understands that we've got a problem on the streets right now. And I want to make it a point that, you know, homelessness is one issue. It's a set of complex issues that takes a lot of work to kind of unfold. Not every homeless person is an addict, and not every addict is homeless. So I want to establish that fact. It's really important. But these are a couple of friends of mine with big monkeys on their backs. And heroin is a major problem, not just in Seattle, but it's all over the country right now. It's in Bellevue, it's in Bothell, it's in Mercer Island. It's horrible. And heroin is very cheap. Right now you can buy heroin on Broadway. I watched it go down last night and every night for about $8 for a dime bag of dope. And, you know, you can't pick up a bottle of Aleve for under 12 or 15 bucks. So right now, you know, heroin is cheaper than aspirin practically, and it's a major problem.
And when you call them your friends, I mean, you're not using a turn of phrase. These are people you actually could consider your friends.
Absolutely. Well, you know, 22 years ago, I made a decision to quit drinking. And it wasn't anything that anybody came up to me and said, hey, you know what, you should do this, or, you know, let me help you show the way. I came to the conclusion that the mistakes I was making were getting worse consecutively, more frequent, and it was clear. So I made a choice that I still look back on as one of the best decisions I ever made. I wasn't able to get there alone. The decision was mine to make, but I had help. And so my friends on the streets, and that's, you know, that's what I think of them at, a lot of them are very vulnerable. You know, they may not have had a choice. There's 15, 16-year-old kids, girls, runaways on the streets that they didn't make the choice to land there. So it's really hard to find people to trust who have been there before, and I take a lot of time and a lot of love with some of these people, because as long as they're standing, there's hope.
So Tim, how did you? Yeah, absolutely. How did you climb out of that dark space yourself, and where did you find yourself next?
Well, it's not as dramatic as one might think. You know, I was 27, 28 years old, and I just found myself pointing fingers at other people, saying, why didn't this happen to me? Am I not as lucky as the next guy? And when am I going to get my big break? And it was largely in part to my father, who had been sober for about 40 years when he passed away. He said, hey, look, are you getting the clear picture? It isn't the rest of the world. Look in the mirror. If you want to find out the source of your problems and your pain, introduce yourself to yourself, because you're the one who's making the shot. So, you know, again, I emphasize that the decision process of discovering that, you know, a clean life, for me, it was alcohol was my number one problem, was the way towards opening that door.
Yeah. And so what did you do? Like, how did you fill the hole that was filled with
that's
alcohol?
A great question. So, you know, addiction, you know, a lot of us here in the room have probably have been impacted. Your neighbors, maybe your parents, a brother or sister. A lot of people in the room understand that when you get rid of one habit, you should probably try to pick something up that's healthier in the long run. And for me, it was golf. I started golfing the next day. I quit drinking. I bought a set of golf clubs. Sorry about that. You know. And I golfed every day. I got to be a scratch golfer within about 8 years. I golfed every day for 10 hours a day. And then it was absurd. It really was. And then finally I realized, I'm spending a lot of time at Jefferson Park, and I'm broke. I don't have anything to show for. You know, my family is famous attorneys and state senators, and I'm gambling up on Jefferson Golf Park, you know. So I did the next logical thing, was I put the golf clubs away and I bought a guitar. And I played the guitar every day, 10 hours a day, for the next 10 years. And I started to record my own music. And at the end of the road, I had an album that was horrible. It was just the worst. I played it for all my friends, and they all, this is beautiful music, and this is really sincere art. It was horrible. It was, and I put that, I sold all my equipment and my guitar, and I was like, what am I going to do now, you know? And I looked around, and I had a camera on the kitchen table, and I was already walking around in circles. That's one thing that I did that I didn't even know that I was doing, really helping myself, was I was walking from Capitol Hill to Madison, Madison down to the waterfront, down to Pioneer Square, from Pioneer Square to Pier 70, back up to Denny, and back home again. It was about a three-hour trip, which kept my mind, I didn't even realize that I was doing it, but the stories that I accumulated along the way, people didn't believe me. So I started taking pictures of these characters, and along came this crazy social media platform called Facebook about 10 years ago. And I posted a couple pictures, and guess what? People started responding to those in a way that guitar singing and golfing never produced. So
you didn't get a lot of followers from golf. That's sad.
So they're already shooting up. Addicts are shooting up in the doorways of Broadway, in the doorways and businesses of Queen Anne, down in Madison Park. They're there. They're doing it, folks. And if we can get them at a safe place, like they've got in Vancouver, where there's social services, clean needles, and places where they can interact with positive attitudes, we can get to some of them. We can save some of them. I promise you, this is the truth. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I was curious about, I mean, between the pretty and the gritty, these two sides, this dialectic of,
sure,
of the place that we live, yep, how do you hold them both in your hands at once? And is there something that brings them together for you?
That's a great question. This is the best city on earth. I was born two blocks away. This neighborhood is the best neighborhood in the city. Sorry. Laurelhurst. I know there's Broadmoor people in here too, but yeah, Capitol Hill's kicking your ass every single night. So, that's just the way it is. There's two sides to this city, if not more. The pretty, the sunsets, the supermoons. I wouldn't rather take photos anywhere else. They've been seen all over the world, and I love showing the rest of the world what we're all about. But there's the other side. This is the side, you know, in the jungle, in the encampments that you see under the freeways when you drive by those tents. My friends, they have no place to go. They're not allowed in Tent City. They're not welcome at the churches. These addicts are... they're lost. They've got no other place to go. So I'm trying to encourage people, look, we've got beautiful sunsets and ferry boats and scenic mountains, but we also have a big problem right now that all of us understands needs some attention. And I really have the utmost confidence in the mayor, the city council. They get it. I met with the governor on Monday, and he gets it too. And so I think we're going to pull together some really smart people to start to address this bigger issue. So two sides of the same coin. City is pretty, and the city is gritty. It's my hometown. It's your guys' hometown. But Gabriel, I love you, brother. You guys have given me a big opportunity tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Tim Durkin, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks, man.
Wow, fantastic. Well, on our show and on our station, we do kind of strive to get the complexity of this region. We do try and capture what it is to live here in all its contrasting glory, the pretty and the gritty. And on our show, when we're doing our job, we're telling stories that have a lot of that in the same story. You know, we really believe that a story can be sad and hilarious and heartbreaking and surprising all at once. It's an eclectic kind of a thing we're trying to do. And I think these next guests are kindred spirits in that respect. You might call what they do jazz if you want, but I think you're going to see very, very clearly that these guys contain multitudes. So I want to welcome very much Evan Flory Barnes on bass, Devon Lewis on drums, Andy Coe on guitar, and Skerrick on sax. It's Skerrick's Bandolabra. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Skerrick's Bandelabra. Man, thank you for being there for your friend in need here, Skerrick. I really appreciate it. So when you think about a band like Bandelabra, how much of the sound of the band comes from something intellectual, comes from the makeup of the instruments, and how much of it comes from the personalities of the players?
Yes.
Well, you got a lot of different projects. You got your fingers in, I don't know, half a dozen different things. I mean, you've played with Critters Bug, and you've got Skerrick's Syncopated Tank Quartet. Septet. Sorry, I cut out three of your septet. There's Garage à Trois, there's the Dead Kenny G's, there's all these different bands. Do they? Yeah. I gather maybe we should pause a second on the Dead Kenny G's. You want to just thumbnail that one for us real quick?
Well, a flight attendant on an airplane once said, "Oh, the Dead Kenny G's, is that a Grateful Dead covers done Kenny G style?"
She was this close.
And so a new band was born.
So these bands all sound, I mean, really different, but you can hear Skerrick in all of them. Do they scratch different creative itches for you? I mean, do they come from different parts of your taste and your personality?
Yeah, necessity is always the mother of invention, right? Did I get it right?
That sounds right.
Ask Tom Robbins, he'll correct me. But you're hearing something. For me, it's really people driven. So the individuals involved. So you know, hearing all of these great Seattle musicians individually, it's just like, oh wow, I'd love to play with him. I'd love to play with that guy. Let's get them all together and see what works. You know, so it's always individually driven, collectively driven.
So you don't necessarily go into it thinking, I'm going to construct a punk, jazz, anti sort of folk thing with a little twist of bebop.
Pro folk.
Yeah.
It's not. Don't get me in trouble.
Is there, have you been kicking around a project or a combination of musicians or styles that you have in mind that might become a project in the future that you haven't actually put into action yet?
Well, instrumental music has been a thing that drives us. I think what we like about it, is some of me and some of my cohorts, is it's not telling people how to think. So it really can trigger each person's imagination individually in a totally unique way, you know, according to what they're hearing. So I really like that, but I do listen to a lot of music with lyrics and words, especially with Bob Dylan's birthday coming up Tuesday.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday, Bob. And Seattle's Dark Lord of the Saxophone, Skerrick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so two down, three to go. Our next guest, Melanie McFarlane, she grew up in a household where TV watching was pretty heavily restricted, and so, of course, consequently, she became a TV writer. And she worked for years as a TV critic for the Seattle PI. A lot of people here probably remember her from that. Yeah? We have a lot of PI alumni, as a matter of fact. She was also, for a number of years, the television editor for IMDb, just down the street. But besides dwelling in the kind of 2D world of television, Melanie also occasionally ventures into the third dimension to do live storytelling. And she's going to join us tonight to give us a story. It's a story about Facebook, a dinner, prison, cancer, and the nature of friendship. Please welcome Melanie McFarlane.
Hopefully you guys can hear me. So, in 2008, a friend of mine called and invited me and my husband out to dinner with her and her husband. And this wasn't a particularly special evening, it was just an evening to touch base. And so we went, my husband and I, we went to a restaurant in Georgetown where we met them. We greeted each other with hugs. We sat down, we looked at the menu. And then she leaned across the table and looked at me and said, "So, how have you been?" Which is an innocuous question. It's general conversation opener for most people when they sit down at dinner. Except for me, that was a tough question to answer. Because you see, in 2008, when the rest of the world was going into one of the worst economic recessions in modern history, I was going into one of the worst depressions of my adult life. In 2008, that was the year that I was still coming to grips with my mother's Alzheimer's diagnosis. I went from a job that I really loved, but I knew it was going to be eliminated, to a job that paid the bills, but my heart just wasn't in. And 2008 was also the year that I witnessed the dissolution, the loss of two of my closest friendships. And as you may know, if you've ever experienced this, if you've lost a friend, you may know that it's a platonic divorce. So you don't just lose the friend, you lose the friends of that friend. So as a result, that was also the year that I went from someone who always had a full social calendar and things to do and places to go, whose phone was always ringing off the hook, to someone who sat there with a dead phone and didn't have much to do at all. And in fact, this friend that had asked me out to dinner, I had reached out many times to maintain our friendship and hadn't heard back from her. So when she did call me, it was like fireworks in the fog, a little bit of hope. And believe me when I tell you, it took me everything just to get off the couch to go to that dinner. Because if you've ever experienced depression, you know that the act of getting out of bed each day feels like lifting the world on your shoulders. So, going back to that moment, how have you been? I decided, well, this is a friend, so I'm going to answer honestly. And I said, well, it hasn't been the easiest year. And in response, she put up her hands as if a fireball were coming down a hallway at her. No, but she didn't say no. What she said was, because of your job, right? Because of your job, everything's really difficult because of your job. It's really hard, right? And I realized, oh, it's going to be one of those evenings. And it was. Anything that I said that was even tangentially related to things we used to enjoy together was met with her stabbing her drink with her straw. And when I say stabbing her drink, I mean if she could have gone full Lizzie Borden on every single bubble that was coming up in that carbonated beverage, that would have happened. But here's a highlight I'll never forget. She actually said, oh, your birthday's coming up. What are you going to do for your birthday? And I said, well, I'm probably going to have a nice evening where I just kind of have an evening of self-care and, you know, maybe meditate or something like that. And her response was, oh, that sounds horrible. You should have a party. Anyway, thank God for my husband. I was done that night. He stepped in and continued the conversation for the rest of the evening so we could maintain this facade of normalcy. And then when it was all over, as soon as the last crumb was consumed off of my plate, I shot up out of my chair, gotta go. And it was car, door, bed, 12-hour nap. I took a lot of 12-hour naps in those days. Interestingly enough, a few weeks later, I was looking on Facebook. And Facebook, for someone like me, who was in a depression, it's basically a window to the world from my aquarium of sadness, just looking out and seeing life go on. And it also helped me maintain the mask, which means I could put up an innocuous song lyric and everything would seem okay. So I put up my innocuous song lyric of whatever it was, and the first person to hit the like button was this friend, which was odd. I went and looked at her page, and according to Facebook, we were still friends, which, again, was bizarre to me because this is somebody who I couldn't even be honest about in terms of letting her know how I was feeling. In the months and years after that incident, I read a lot about the nature of friendship and relationships. I did this for a number of reasons. Number one, I wanted to figure out what it was about me that was so monstrous that no one wanted to be around me. Number two, I was pretty sure I wasn't the only person who had gone through this. And I also wanted to understand the nature of friendship. What should we expect from our friends? Am I expecting too much? What should I be doing? And generally, that's the great thing about being a journalist, is that when I have a question, a quandary in life, I can always find the answer with research. So if you were to talk to me, I could give you a million different quotes and observations about friendship from all the essays and articles and books that I read. But for the purposes of this conversation, I'm going to focus on two. One is a quote. It's a quote from Marlene Dietrich, the actress. And that quote is, "It's the friends you can call up at 4 a.m. that matter." And that quote gave me so much comfort in that time because I had my 4 a.m. friends. So there is that. And then there's a study by an evolutionary psychologist and anthropologist. His name is Robin Dunbar. Robin Dunbar is known for what's called the Dunbar number. And the Dunbar number is 150. 150, according to Robin Dunbar, is the number that the human brain can maintain in terms of maintaining stable relationships. And the way he got that number was from looking at primates. That was actually his main area of study. He observed primates in social settings, how they groomed each other to maintain social hierarchy and bonding. And he looked at the neocortex of the primate brain, and he compared it to the size of the human brain. And based on a number of different calculations he did, he came to that number, 150. Now, what that means is that any of us can have 150 people that we know their names, know their faces, generally know enough about them to have a conversation, and how they relate to the people around us. There are subsets within that number, 50. 50 is a number of people that you feel closer to, that you can invite over to your house for dinner or for a big party. Now, those 50 people, if you have a tragedy in your life or something's going wrong, and you put it up on Facebook, those 50 people will give you a like, or actually now that Facebook has new emoticons, a sad face, or a flower. But then there's 15. 15's the number of people that if you're going through a tough time, those people will give you a call. They'll come over to your house. If you can't get up out of bed, they'll bring you food. They'll generally make sure that you're okay. And then there's that other subset of 5. Those are your 4 a.m. friends. So stepping back, I looked at my Facebook page at that time, 2008, and purely out of coincidence, I had about 150 Facebook friends. And I looked down the line at each name on that list and tried to figure out how many of those Facebook friends could I give an honest answer to that question of, how have you been? Not many. So I decided to give myself a little early birthday present of self-care. I poured myself a big glass of wine. I turned the lights down low. I put on some soothing music. And I proceeded to unfriend 60% of the people on my Facebook list. So long, guy who has the email account that commemorates his favorite orgy. Bye-bye, yoga instructor who is single-handedly the meanest, most inflexible, judgmental person, except when she was on the mat. And basically, if you have a given name from your parents and a playa name that you earned from running around at Burning Man, I bid you adieu. All in all, at the end of that early birthday present, I went down to about 50 Facebook friends, 50 people, all of whom I would have over to my home for a party or for dinner. 50 people. That was 2008. It is 2016. I have 860 Facebook friends. How did that happen? Well, Facebook has changed, right? And our relationship with Facebook has changed. But I can tell you definitively, it comes down to two words: Syrian Revolution. Now, you may wonder what I have to do with the Syrian Revolution. I don't have much to do with it. However, one of my 4 a.m. friends, Dorothy Parvaz, was very connected to the Syrian Revolution. In 2011, my phone rang at work. And keep in mind, my phone doesn't ring, so when my phone rings, I generally know it's probably something pretty important. So I remember answering the phone, getting up from my desk to go to someplace private, walking down a hallway, and hearing a Seattle Times reporter. And the reporter said, "Dorothy Parvaz." And I said, "Yeah, it's great. She's working in Al Jazeera English. She's over in Doha. She's doing great." Because I'm thinking this person is asking about, oh, it's a reference. She's going to want to hire Dorothy back so she can come home. And the next words the reporter said was, "She's gone missing." I've never experienced this in my life. But my knees didn't just stop working. They turned into pudding. And I remember taking a step and my whole lower body going out from under me and reaching over and putting my hand on a wall to hold myself up. And I pulled myself together. I found a room. I answered the reporter's questions. And I made my way back to my desk, doing my best to hold it together. And I went on Facebook, because I knew that somebody out there had the answers, and I was right. Her colleagues at Al Jazeera English had already put together a page for her. Mutual friends of ours who worked with her and with me at the Seattle Times and the Seattle PI were pulling together. People from all over the country who knew her, and even in Canada, where she grew up, they were reaching out to us. We were bonding. We were forming this network. I was friending people left and right. Anybody who could help me get the word out about my missing friend. Because it's terrifying when somebody you love just seems to vanish into a hole. I wanted her back. So all of us did everything we could, and what we did was we wrote. We put things up on Facebook where we talked about how much we missed her. We put demands up on Facebook. Anyone who wanted to talk to me, any news organization, I talked on the radio, I spoke to Canadian journalists, anybody who wanted to talk to me, I spoke to them. And it's a really good thing that we all did that. Because in the Iranian prison where Dorothy was being held, her interrogators were looking at everything we were putting up on Facebook. You see, what had happened was, Dorothy is an intrepid reporter. And when the Syrian Revolution began, they kicked all of the journalists out of Syria. But reporting still needs to be done. So she had her passport, her Iranian passport, because she has triple citizenship. She has Iranian citizenship, American citizenship, and Canadian citizenship. But for this purposes of this, she had her Iranian passport. She landed at the airport in Damascus. She went to customs. The officials looked. They asked her some questions. They went through her bag. They found the satellite phone. They searched her more. They found her American passport, which she had to have to enter and exit Doha. And inside that were her residence papers, which said she was a journalist at Al Jazeera. And that, in her words, was when all hell broke loose. They took her off to a Syrian secret prison for 3 days. Nothing happened to her physically, but she could hear people near her being beaten, screaming for their relatives. And then they sent her off to the prison in Iran. And all of that was happening while we were putting things up on Facebook. But I can happily tell you that because of all these efforts we made, yesterday marks the 5th anniversary of Dorothy being freed. She is now running around in New York and says hello to all of you. So what is Facebook to us anyhow? Well, we have a lot of different ideas of what it is. It can be something that is some sort of evil force that's spying on us. It can cheapen our friendships. Or it can be a place where we can connect and bring each other together for great causes. I have another friend who right now, her name is Rose, and she is fighting cancer. She also happens to be homeless and is couch surfing her way through chemo. She recently went to an oncologist's appointment, and she looked around in the waiting room and noticed that she was the only person there who didn't have somebody sitting with her. And the only thing she could think to do was to pick up her phone and go on her Facebook page and say, "I am at the doctor's office right now. I'm the only one who doesn't have anyone here with me, and I feel so alone and scared." And she got a phone call, and someone sat with her on the phone and sat with her until finally it was her time to go see the doctor. And she said that made all the difference. And she says to her, Facebook gives her a way to scream into the void and get a gentle answer back. So I bring all this up to bring us here tonight. We are here right now in this real space with real people making real connections on behalf of a virtual friend. Because to me, KPLU is really one of my 4 a.m. friends in a real sense. One of the things, if any of you live with depression, one of the lovely gifts with package is insomnia. And so there'd be times when I'd get up and leave my husband in bed so he could sleep and go into the living room and turn on the radio, and there would be some music or some voices, and I'd feel comforted and not feel so alone. And I know that some of you, probably in here, maybe found out about this event through Facebook. Possibly. And if that's the case, if a tool like this, with all of its flaws, can bring people together to help a friend in need and to serve a greater good, then the only thing that I can say is, like. Thank you so much.
Melanie McFarland, I feel bad that she had to use my short person's microphone. Well, it's kind of a cliche of our business that radio is a very intimate medium because, I mean, it is. We are with you in some of the most personal times and spaces in your life. We are there in your bedroom, and we are there in your car, and we are there in your water closet, probably. And it is. I mean, we're talking to you right in your ear holes, man. Well, our next guest, Kimya Dawson, her music is incredibly intimate, so intimate that it feels like it's coming from inside your own head sometimes. I want to just crib something from a 10-year-old bio on K Records, because I just find it so apropos. They wrote that her recordings make it feel as though you have a friend there with you whispering in your ear, and you do, because Kimya is your friend. Well, she's coming through for her friends in a really big way tonight, and she's going to join us in conversation and to play a little bit of music. Ladies and gentlemen, our full-time friend, Kimya Dawson. Hey, Kimya.
Hi.
Welcome.
That's a lot of people.
I know, right? Very strange. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what your life was like growing up, and specifically I wanted to talk to you about how you kind of fit into your family's ecosystem as you were growing up. What role did you play?
Well, I was a middle child, the only daughter, so I have an older brother and a younger brother. And when I was, my younger brother's 4 years younger than me, and when he was a baby, he got really, really sick. And for a while, nobody knew what was wrong with him. And so there was this period of time where he was in the hospital, and it was really scary. And I was just like, I can try to make everybody happy. You know, and my mom had a rough go at things when she was growing up, and that was never a secret in our family, that her family life was hard. And so I always wanted to make her happy and have her not feel scared and just make everybody feel okay. I wanted to protect my little brother because I had thought he was going to die. I had been prepared for that, and I wanted to take care of everyone.
And how, did that stick with you? I mean, how did that shape the person that you developed into as an adolescent and then as a young adult? I mean, did you still think of yourself as the person whose job it was to make other people feel better?
Oh, yeah. I definitely was just like, I am strong enough to hold it together and make sure everyone else is okay. And when I was in middle school, I became best friends with a girl whose older sister was killed. She was hit by a train, and my like number one crush was the boy whose like both of his parents had died. And like I was like drawn to people who had just had these like huge tragedies, and I just wanted to make everything okay for them all the time.
So how did it start to become clear to you that that role has a cost?
That's becoming clear to me now. at 43. I devoted a lot of high school to, like, we had to do like 30 hours of community service to graduate high school, and I did like 975 hours working in soup kitchens and homeless shelters and doing other street outreach work. And I was really devoted to doing that type of service work. And then I did a lot of activism. My first year in college, I was in Boston, and my older brother was made active duty and sent over for the first Gulf War in the Marine Corps. And so I was doing a lot of protesting and activism. And then I transferred to Evergreen, and I was doing activism down there. And then at some point, I got kicked out for activism. And but then I just kind of, like, I hit this wall where I was just like, oh, I can't save the world. Like, they're not letting me save the world. And so I started drinking a lot. And then had some really destructive years that ended with a coma. And so 17 years ago, I went to treatment and quit drinking. And then the following weekend was the first Moldy Peaches show. And the first songs that I had written were about feeling awkward and stuff like that. And so then kids would come up to me afterwards and be like, whoa, like I haven't really heard anybody say like, I feel fat and awkward, you know, like in a song before. And like, this boy doesn't want to talk to me. And so I was like, whoa, you feel like that too, you know? And so then that, it kind of just morphed how I could make people feel better. And then it created this sort of illusion for me. Well, it wasn't an illusion because it really helped. But like, I would have these kids come up to me and say like, oh, you feel like this. And there were these states of being that I thought, you know, my whole life that I had been alone in, you know, and just like, oh, I'm an alien, like, ah. And then, so people would come up and tell me they felt like that too, and then that would make me feel better, you know? And so I was like, oh, if I tell you I feel like then you'll tell me you feel like and then we both feel better because we're not the only person that feels like you know? And so And so that was really great, and it, like, you know, helped me stay sober and helped me connect with people. But then it sort of became, over time, the type of thing. And I guess because, too, in the beginning, I didn't have email, you know? And so as, like, musicians become more accessible and start touring more, and then there's more people who want to tell you their story, and it's really heavy, you know? And so it's like, I'm still that little kid that's like, I gotta fix them all, you know? And so, like, I'm getting, like, these emails, and after every show, there's, like, a line of people out the door who are just like, my mom has cancer, or I'm, like, 1 week sober, or, like, my dad died last night. Like, seriously, like, every show. And I'm just like, I will hug you all, you know? And then realizing, like, I'm absorbing all of this grief, like, day after day after day. And then it got to the point where, like, it just became, like, this codependency, and, like, I have to take care of everybody. I have to take care of everybody. And then recognizing that I wasn't even taking care of myself, and that I didn't even know how, you know, and that I would, like, have all these answers for everyone, but, like, I didn't really know the answers, you know? It's like I could read, like, a million self-help books and, like, spew out all this crap, but it's like I didn't really know what I was talking about because I couldn't apply it.
So what do you...
I still want to fix everybody, though. I love you. Like, and, but it's just, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a, you know, that same K Records bio, it's a very incisive bio writer, wrote something like that your music makes it feel like you need us just as much as we need you. And I wonder how that feels from your end.
I think that's very true, but at the same time, like, what I've been learning, it's, like, so hard because I do wish I could save everybody, you know? And it's like I told you when we were talking the other day, there's, like, a girl who called me once, and she was like, my mom's a drug dealer, her boyfriend is, you know, got her into this. I have a little brother. I just turned 18. Our house is about to be raided. And since I'm 18, if I get caught, and she was like, and I'm an addict, if I get caught, I'm going to go to jail because there's a minor in the house. And so I drove to her house and I picked her up and I drove her to rehab. And then she wrote to me later and was like, you saved my life. And then, like, 5 years later, she died of an OD. And it's just like, I saved you, oh, you know? And I just feel like my heart just breaks over and over again. And then I end up being really depressed, you know? And I feel like what I've been realizing is that, like, I have stuff from when I was 4 years old that I've squashed in there so tight. And instead of looking at the stuff that makes me sad or that was making my mom sad, I just, like, look at everybody else's stuff and I'm like, it's within my control to tell you what you should do, you know? And so what I've been trying to do lately is, like, get to the root of, like, my stuff and just, like, I still want to, like, fix everybody else, but I've realized that I have to have boundaries. Which is really hard, you know?
Sounds like a new concept.
It's so hard. But just, like, there's some nights on tour where I'm just like, I hear somebody like, I want to hug you after I play, and I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, I have to sit here. And, you know, it's like that self-care piece is so hard.
Have you learned one piece of that you are getting good at? Are you able to find some way to create some space for yourself or find some way to take care of yourself that comes a little easier now?
It's such a messed up balance because it's like I try to be like, I need boundaries and I need to take time for myself, and then I'm like, I'm isolating. And so I never know, like, if I'm taking care of myself or if I'm, like, unhealthily afraid of the world and, like, hiding in my apartment alone. And I'm just like, oh, no. What's healthy? And then I'm like, maybe I'd feel better if I started working at a soup kitchen again. And then I'm like, oh, wait. Like, maybe I'd feel better if I went to therapy 7 days a week. Like, I just don't know. But I'm working on it. But if I don't respond to your email, it's not because I don't love you. It's because I love you too much. I love you so much, it's killing me.
Well, I think you've helped so many of us through your music, even though, you know, maybe we haven't emailed with you or given you a physical hug. It's a sonic hug. So I wonder if you could give us one tonight. Do you have a song you could play for us?
I do.
All right.
My guitar's going to materialize.
That's right. Ready?
Thank you. This is a song. Whoa, suddenly the sound has changed. This is a song about something that happened when I was little. And I realized, I was just on tour in Europe for 3 weeks, and I realized on that tour that the year that this incident happened was the year that Purple Rain came out. And sometimes when I get long emails from people where I'm like, oh, this is really heavy, then I always say to myself, this is the Sting letter, because when I was in high school, I wrote a really long letter to Sting. But I didn't send it. But I always have to remember where I was at, you know, where I was just like, imagine, now I imagine Sting being like, wow, she really loved that cat, you know? But yeah, this is a little bit about how Elton John helped too. And I think about all the ways that like Sting and Elton John and like Phil Collins and like all the soft rock that I was really into, like how all those people had such a big effect on me, even though I didn't have direct access to them all the time. And then I like to think maybe on the days that I can't respond to people that maybe I'm still helping somehow. I was 12 and things had been pretty okay up till then. The only deaths I'd experienced were pets and the grandparents of my friends. I was aimed gifted and talented till right around the 7th grade. But that is when everything changed and I had to flip the switch and shut off my brain. 'Cause if I thought too much, I'd get sick to my stomach and I would feel like giving up or throwing up. It was just too tough. 'Cause that is when I realized that even little babies cry. Oof, I just tried to erase what happened. That is when I realized that even little babies die, and I had to build a wall inside to keep me from losing my mind. He was only 9 months old, a kid I'd babysit and hug and hold, and I would tickle his toes and pat his head and watch his chest rise and fall as he slept in his crib. And then my dad said late last night, a truck driver hit their car, he didn't survive. And his mom was hurt bad, but his dad is all right. His big brother is fine, cause he stayed at the party. Yeah, yeah, Steven is fine, cause he stayed at the party. And if I thought too much, I'd get sick to my stomach, and I would feel like giving up or throwing up. It was just too tough. Sometimes things happen when we are small that we just don't have the tools to deal with at all. So we bottle it up and we just don't see how the stuff that we stuff will affect who we'll be. What protects us as kids slowly makes us insane. So I'm trying to dismantle barricades brick by brick in an attempt to set free my brain. Brick by brick in an attempt to set free my brain. And I just hope that my heart is stronger now. So much stronger than it was when I was 12. When if I thought too much, I'd get sick to my stomach, and I would feel like giving up or throwing up. It was just too tough. And I'd sing Daniel again and again and pretend you were just traveling on a plane. Quarter century later, it's still hard to take, but with every red taillight, I scream out your name. Yeah, with every red taillight, I scream out your name. Yeah, with every red taillight, I scream out your name. I say, Daniel, Daniel, Daniel. I say, Daniel, Daniel, Daniel. I say, Daniel, Daniel, Daniel. Baby boy, baby boy, baby boy. Baby boy, baby boy, baby boy. Baby boy, baby boy, baby boy, baby boy.
Is that it?
Okay.
Kimya Dawson. How lucky are we to have Kimya Dawson in our town, right? Whew. All right, deep breath. Short person.
I'm way taller on the radio.
So, as we've been thinking tonight about this whole idea of taking these relationships, these friendships that we have over distances, whether it's over a virtual space or over the airwaves, and making them real, bringing people together here under one roof. I gotta say, our last guest, I just never imagined I would share a physical space with the guy. When I was an adolescent, I thought Tom Robbins must be some kind of like phantasm. He was some sort of like luminous, psychedelic being. I pictured the aliens from Cocoon when they unzip their skin. So imagine my surprise, the guy is a real human. And one of the great, great pleasures as a grown-up now of reading his memoir, Tibetan Peach Pie, has been to get to know that human being. And I have to say, it's been a little like, you know, meeting the man behind the curtain and finding out he's actually way cooler and more interesting than the Wizard of Oz. So I am so honored tonight to welcome Tom Robbins, reading from his memoir about a little stretch of his life where he was in my line of work, kind of. Ladies and gentlemen, Washington State's own American author, Tom Robbins.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Wow, I didn't expect this. Well, in the midst of this heroic and, I'm confident, successful effort to save KPLU, I was perversely reminded of my own career in radio. In the mid-60s, I was feeling that it was time to finally sit down and start writing those books I had planned to write since the age of 5. But I was involved a lot in the Seattle art world, and projects kept coming up, and I kept getting sidetracked by interesting things. And as if I didn't have enough distractions, I agreed in late 1966 to host a weekly show on KRAB-FM. You're all too young to remember, Crab. One of the very first listener-supported radio stations in the nation, and probably the world. Called with a nod to Dostoevsky, Notes from the Underground, the show aired at 10 o'clock on Sunday nights, a less than ideal spot for a broadcast. The signal outside the greater Seattle area was as weak as baby bird farts. And my voice was so flat and bedraggled, it made Smokey the Bear sound like Beyoncé. Nevertheless, Notes from the Underground had devoted listeners from the start, primarily because it dealt in a positive and even celebratory manner with the three basic food groups of the era: sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Skating on ice just barely thick enough to keep from plunging the worried station into the punitive waters of the FCC, I delivered audacious bits, often culled from underground newspapers, on such timely topics as civil rights, war resistance, ecology, abortion, police brutality, political corruption, consciousness-expanding chemicals, and alternative lifestyles. Mostly, however, I played recorded music. The new music, shunned by commercial stations from coast to coast. It happened to be one of those rare times in the course of human history when the popular music of the day was also artistically and socially important music, though you'd never know it from listening to AM radio. Wed to a rigid old format that demanded that no song on the air exceed 3 minutes in length, AM stations stubbornly refused to play album cuts, the majority and best of which had broken free from the 3 minute straitjacket. So even the Beatles, the Stones, Jefferson Airplane, the Doors, and others even as they dramatically altered the soundscape of the English-speaking world. Commercial radio sugared the airwaves with bubblegum singles. Inner cities were burning, an unnecessary and immoral war was raging. Gender stereotypes were in flux. Protesters of many stripes challenged the barricades. An unprecedented generation of ecstatic truth seekers flirted with its neurological destiny. And all the while, Seattle's KJR and KOL trotted out a teeny bopper soundtrack of oral fluff. For a couple of hours on Sunday night, Notes from the Underground sought to provide a relevant, sympathetic, irreverent refuge from obnoxious advertising, disc jockey prattle, and top 40 inanities. In fairness, many AM stations did eventually come around, adopting a playlist of songs from higher up the food chain. Although, for example, I was playing The Doors' Light My Fire a good 6 months before it aired on KJR. And with that, children, I, whose voice was the vocal equivalent of week-old roadkill on a Tennessee truck route in mid-July, with that, I made my contribution to radio broadcasting. I could have made another. Well, one Sunday, as I waited to go on the air, a stranger dropped by Cara B's rather ramshackle one-story wood frame studio. Thin as a spaghetti, the guy had long, wild black hair, a pointed black beard, and wore a Mexican poncho across which, like a bandolier, was strapped a cheap guitar. In other words, he looked not unlike a thousand or more other skinny, hairy, ostensibly musical young men then yo-yoing up and down America's West Coast. He talked like them as well. Scarcely introducing himself, he said his name was Charlie, before treating me to an earful of peace, love, and total liberation. Even as he mouthed the prevailing hippie philosophy, however, he did it with an articulation that was impressive and an intensity that was nothing short of galvanizing. The more Charlie talked, the more convinced I became that he not only true believed that philosophy, he, for one, was actually living it. There was a purity about him, a blaze in his eyes that bordered on the charismatic. I also had the sense that hanging out with him would be dangerous. Not because he might prove mean, violent, dishonest, or crazier than anybody else I knew, but because he seemed both completely uncompromised and completely uncompromising. As Henry Miller said of Rimbaud, he was like a man who discovered electricity but knew absolutely nothing about insulation. At any rate, the dude said he wrote songs and wished to perform a selection of them on Notes from the Underground, with which he was somehow, he was not a local resident, familiar. Ordinarily, I would have consented, for while my shows were fairly well organized, it would have violated their spirit, the spirit of the times, not to be open to, even eager for, change and surprise. The following morning, however, I was leaving on a month-long jaunt to Arizona, and for that show only, I'd actually scripted a program with a beginning, middle, and end. any interruption of the Aristotelian flow would have sabotaged it, completely wrecking the desired cumulative effect. So I turned Charlie down and sent him on his way. Visibly disappointed, but polite enough about it, he shuffled off into the summer Sunday night and vanished there. 2 years would pass before I recognized his picture in the newspaper and realized that for better or for worse, I'd rejected and turned down an opportunity to tape a live performance by Charles Manson. Thank you. I believe that my engineer from that crab show is in the audience tonight. Are you here, Chuck? Raise your hand. He can attest that it's all true.
Treating us to that was fantastic. I was wondering how long it's been since you've heard some of the tapes from those days at Crab.
Oh, it's been a very long time. A lot of jelly has run through the donut since then.
Well, thanks to a really fantastic resource called crab.fm, the Crab Radio Archives, I think Chuck has something to do with it. We have a little flavor. Can we hear that now, guys?
Hello there. This is the voice of the other America. The music, the news, the values, the mood of the subculture. Tom Robbins here, acting as a sort of host, rapping and tapping and zapping, and welcoming you with respect and love to the sounds of a society within a society. The alternative to that joyless, sick, and criminal travesty that is middle-class Seattle. This is the underground. This is its sound.
So, Tom. what does that conjure up in you when you hear that?
I always begin the show with a cut from a song by the Fugs. Anybody remember the Fugs? got hair growing around my nose and throat. Don't ever exercise my right to vote. But if you see me on the streets, you say, Jesus Christ! But I'm getting high, I'm doing all right. And then it was, good evening, it's rock and roll for big boys and girls.
Well, help us sort of set the scene. Like, how square was middle-class Seattle at that time, and what did you feel like needed to be done to counteract it?
Well, it was no more square. I mean, in fact, it was a lot less square than middle-class Nebraska. But it was a very turbulent and very interesting and in many ways inspiring time. And a certain segment of the population chose to ignore it. And I was doing my best to disrupt their ignorance.
And you had a lot of tools in your toolbox to do that. And we have another little piece of tape from this show that aired in 1967 that I think gets across. Let's hear that now.
Some people have said that last week's show was ridiculous, and I think they're probably right. I don't apologize for it because the underground has many faces, and being silly and ridiculous is a pretty prominent face. As Lorenzo Milam, who is the boss and captain here at Crab, said in his column that Seattle needed more nonsense. And, well, here's where he's going to get it, right here in his own station. But seriously, nonsense is both a form of wisdom and a means of survival. Alan Watts, the philosopher, has said, if a culture cannot afford an area in itself where pure nonsense happens, an area that is not practical, that has no objectives, that exists for no reason whatsoever, then that culture is dead.
So I don't know how easy that is to hear for you, but how important was nonsense to you as you were forming as a writer and as an artist? What role did it play and why did it matter?
you're speaking as if it was in the past tense.
Well, let's go ahead and rephrase that, shall we?
Well, humor, and not nonsense, is one of the higher forms of humor, and humor is both a form of wisdom and a means of survival.
So you write about this moment in Tibetan Peach Pie, a kind of epiphany that you had about nonsense, sort of the sublime and the ridiculous existing together. And I'm thinking about this moment that you write about, it was while you were watching a movie. The movie was The Fisher King. And you saw something on the screen that kind of opened up your mind to the way that these two things can coexist and how they need to coexist. Do you remember that? How can you walk us through that epiphany?
Well, there's a scene in The Fisher King, if I am remembering it correctly, where Robin Williams was living in a basement apartment, and wasn't even really an apartment. He was more or less squatting in this basement. There were a lot of pipes and ducts and things overhead. But he had a shrine, a little spiritual Buddhist shrine. And had that little figure of Buddha and incense burners and the things you would normally find in an Asian spiritual shrine, but he also had a little plastic packet of Chinese restaurant takeout soy sauce. And when I saw that and recognized the soy sauce there in the midst of those other icons, I was suddenly transformed. I was lifted out of my seat because realizing, yeah, this is what it's all about, you know? Life is the beautiful joke that's always happening.
The thinking about your time at Crab and the stuff you were talking about and that was preoccupying you at that time, sex, drugs, rock and roll, etc. It also occurs to me that was happening right before your first novel came out of you. And I wonder, as it was incubating in there and you were doing this work at Crab, you were talking about whatever was on your mind, what you thought was important, did that start to bleed out into the book that eventually kind of tumbled out of your head? Did you work anything out during that time, or did you clarify anything for yourself that would crystallize later in those really important first novels that you wrote?
I'm not sure I have any idea. As I said, I actually literally started writing when I was 5 years old. And I went through a lot of incarnations before the late 60s when I finally wrote my first novel. I think I was searching for my voice. I had my theme, or a selection of themes, and I realized that After a Doors concert, I went home and wrote a review for the Helix and realized the next day when I read that review that this is the way I wanted to write my novel, that I could that I could, because I'd been in journalism, I'd been working for newspapers, but I realized that I could write a novel less like a journalist and more like a poet. And that was a moment of epiphany for me.
Well, as long as we're thinking about... Absolutely. As long as we're thinking about epiphanies or satori, as you talk about, moments of enlightenment, glimpses of enlightenment, there's one more I wanted to ask you about that you write about in Tibetan Peach Pie, and it was one that happened when you were quite young, and it also involved a movie. When you went to see a movie that included the very young, I think 8 years old, Natalie Wood, right?
Yes.
What was that moment, and what did it mean to you?
Oh, man. I can't remember. I remember the experience. I can't remember the title of the film. But it was a very moving picture. And I'd gone with my parents to a town 12 miles from the town we lived in, which did not have a first-run movie theater. And something in the pain and the beauty of little 8-year-old Natalie Wood touched my 8-year-old heart, and I had an epiphany in the back seat of my parents' car on the way home. I suddenly felt as if I was not only sharing her pain and her overcoming of the pain, but that of everyone else in the world, everyone who was suffering and everyone who was on the road to something higher. So I had never been taught anything like that in Southern Baptist Sunday School. But on the way home, I had a feeling of being encompassed by universal love, so real. And I was in a state that was so real, it would have made Sir Francis, St. Francis of Assisi seem like a mink rancher. I thought we were going to talk about radio.
I can't help it, sorry. As one of the people, and I'm sure there's a lot of us in this room who have reached insights about humanity and about ourselves and the kind of people that we want to be from reading your novels, I just want to say thanks.
Thank you. Can I say something? I just wanted to say that radio has always seemed more real to me than television.
Guys, that was fantastic. We're like done. Listen, before we go, I just want to let you know that Tom is going to be, for a brief stretch, signing books downstairs. We're going to have to vacate before too terribly long, but he is going to make himself available, which is incredibly generous of him. We're wrapping this up, but I have a bunch of people to thank, so don't go away. I want to thank our guests, Tim Durkin, Scarix Bandalabra, Melanie McFarland, Kimya Dawson, and Tom Robbins. And a whole bunch of people here. I'm going to do it real quick. I want to thank Aaron Hennessy, Kevin Kniestad, Ali Ferguson, Brenda Goldstein-Young, Lowell Kiso, Nick Winter, Joey Cohn, Matt Martinez, Ginny Palmer, Rebecca Jones, Clint Tasker, Chuck Reinch of Crab.fm, Arwen Nix, Warren Langford, Bree Ripley, John Kessler, Town Hall Seattle,
Promotion Arts New Media, Sweet Wheels for the ice cream. The official sponsor of Sound Effect is WSECU, and I want to thank all of you so much for coming. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.